Well, hello, everyone. Good afternoon, and welcome to Open Sources Guelph for another week. And this week, the tables have turned just a teeny tiny bit because this is Scotty Hertz back at the controls for the first time in a while. I've unearthed a secret bunker in my yard. I think it's Soviet issue, Cold War, definitely. But the gear that was down there was absolutely amazing. I thought I would give it a spin, and I'm piping myself in via an alternative bunker this week, let's say, but the gear is much better suited to the job than, let's say, what's in the actual Hertz bunker. And I'm very pleased, of course, as always, to be joined, at least I hope so, by Adam A. Donaldson from the Guelph Politico Hacienda in the North End. Adam, are you there? Adam is here. I just can't find him just yet. One more time. Adam Donaldson, are you there?
I'm here.
Oh, there we go.
Coming in and out.
There we go. See, I was having trouble with some of the tubes, I've managed to get everything back in order. So people may hear a slight hum or a buzzing or whatever. That's just.
Well, you insisted that you were now an internet expert and a technology guru. And
when did I ever insist that? Like 1999.
Well, hey, it's no Y2K, so you've got that going.
It's written on a piece of paper. Yeah, yeah. I only found one machine that failed, so of thousands. Good to hear from you again. What's going on? Anything to report from the north of town? Other than everything we're going to talk about.
It's windy up here in the north. Winter is coming.
Oh, yeah. The polar vortex should keep some people in and keep that social distancing going for another little while, at least a week or a few days. So yeah, I guess I'll do the intros in the spirit of complete role reversal. Today we're going to be talking about COVID conspiracy theories. Oh, don't we love a good conspiracy theory? And the protests that we've seen regarding shutdowns and government power, the gun control vote that will need to come due to the government's gun control legislation that was announced last week, personal support workers and long-term care, both in Ontario and in Canada and pretty much around the world. We'll probably be sticking to our nation and discussing that. And the Kent State anniversary, the shootings at Kent State was 50 years ago this past week.
Mm-hmm.
And the lasting effects of that, I guess. We'll talk about that closer to the end of the show. But right off the top, let's get right to it. As I said, you and I love a good conspiracy. So what's the news today, Adam? What's today's conspiracy? There's been some good ones.
Well, it's interesting.
Any fresh ones
or
other than? Yeah, go ahead.
Well, it's interesting you should ask because it was one of the things trending right now on the Twitters is Jacob Wool, who people may recognize the name. He's been connected to a variety of allegations against people like Elizabeth Warren and against. I can't remember who else he's, but he's basically a big old Trump supporter. He's this like 20-something kid, early 20-something kid. Him and his partner, Jack Brewster, somehow magically find these people who are have up-to-the-minute allegations against people who are sort of the latest Trump adversaries. And the latest is Anthony Fauci. And basically the news is today the person who they who came to them with the accusation, it turned out that they were paying her to level a fake accusation against Dr. Anthony Fauci, who has been sort of the face of the COVID-19 response. And actually, this is, I hate to say this, but this is kind of like a light conspiracy theory because everybody knows that Jacob Wool and his partner are kind of BS artists, so nobody really took them seriously. The only reason this kind of got reported was because the woman turned around and outed them as sort of setting her up to with a fake accusation against Fauci.
Wow, it sounds like there's something daily, or at least every couple of days, that just You say to yourself, what the heck is going on? I was reading just before our time there about the failed Venezuelan invasion. That sounds like quite the story. I wasn't able to dig too deeply, but it seems like there was a group or a posse from the U.S. that tried to invade Venezuela. And that sounds like conspiracy theory, but it sounds like one of the people that was spearheading it was very into QAnon. And maybe we can talk about that. We're sort of running out of time for this topic already, but in terms of jamming in the 20 to 40 different ones that have been going on. So to me, this, as Spock would say, this is absolutely fascinating. You know, the vaccine's going to have a microchip in it. It was made in Wuhan. I heard one that Disney Plus released it so people would stay home and stream Baby Yoda all day. The 5G tower, burning 5G towers. Did you hear this in Quebec? They're like setting 5G towers on fire because they're seem to be spreading this.
Yeah. Yeah, no, and Justin Trudeau, the prime minister of our country, had to tweet about that this morning, saying like, hey, everyone, don't set fire to the cell towers because, you know, that's how people are getting their phone service and internet and, you know, the things that people need to stay connected in the middle of this lockdown. And I would add at the same time that the cell towers that have been burned, because the conspiracy theory goes that 5G the 5G towers transmit some frequency that mutates your DNA and makes you susceptible to COVID or something to that effect. But the towers that have been burned in Quebec, at least according to the people who own the towers, like the big telecoms, Bell, TELUS, Rogers, are saying they're actually 3G and 4G towers.
So they're classic towers. 3G is like almost classic now, right? It's like we're a couple G's down from that. So yeah, I think I'm pretty sure the 2G's been taken offline completely. But we've got 3, 4, and 5, and the 5's are easy to see. I've seen
with 3G.
What's that?
It's hard to get service now even with 3G.
Yeah, they're winding it all down. I think I've seen some 5G towers in town, and please don't burn them down, people. Some of the other ones, Purell marketing ploy. Purell released the COVID so they would sell more hand sanitizer.
Well, if they did, mission accomplished, because that was the hand sanitizer sales were up 600% in March.
It's that high, eh? Wow. Yeah. And of course, Trump isn't helping. No. At all. We did talk a bit about the disinfectant inside the body. Takes it out in a minute, and it sounds like calls to poison control were up because it's like, I drank bleach or whatever's going on. So the never-ending stuff there. But to touch on it a bit before we change it up, another weekend of protest at Queen's Park. It sounds like on and off the peak numbers were a bit higher, 300 people this time, maybe brought up by some slightly better weather. I don't know.
Yeah, and I'm glad you mentioned that because if you go to Press Progress, which is connected to the Broadbent Institute, which is Ed Broadbent, one of the longtime leaders of the NDP, so you know it's not an unpartisan news outlet, but they do some pretty good reporting. And one of the things they reported on was this group that's kind of organizing these protests, the Free North Patriots. And
they tracked
down.
Yeah.
Yeah, they tracked down the guy who's kind of the organizer, whose name is Michael Boutros, whose own Facebook page is kind of dicey in that it's got like stock photos, and he seems to have a lot of friends in Africa and the Philippines.
Oh.
He says he's like a security consultant with this company, GCT Security Investigations. Press Progress went to the government of Ontario to find out about their credentials. It turns out they are licensed trainers for like security personnel in Ontario. However, that was not approved until several days after the Press Progress article was published.
Right.
So somebody was trying to backstop that in a really obvious and this person, Michael Boutros, then tried to spoof his own Facebook page by changing the name on it. He changed the name, but he didn't change any of like the other information on it, and then tried to hide like where he was. And the reason I tie this back to Jacob Wool, of course, is because one of Jacob Wool's great conspiracy attempts, you know, had him bringing, oh, this information came forward from this security, private security company, which he completely made up, and even used his own picture, I mean, shaded deeply in Photoshop, but using his own picture as the profile image of the CEO of this quote-unquote private security company on the website. So, I mean, there's a long history of people like Jacob Wool and Michael Boutros who, you know, make up entire companies out of whole cloth in order to backstop their crazy conspiracy theories. And sadly, it does seem like there are significant numbers of people who do end up buying into it.
Round up the usual yahoos. It would seem. And I heard Ed the Sock was reporting live on location. I didn't see any of that. I haven't seen Ed the Sock in years. But isn't it great, though, that Ontario isn't an open carry place? Protester or no, I'm always happy that, I'll put it this way, there's certain times I'm in the States and I'm uneasy because as we've seen in Michigan and other places in the U.S., that scene at the Capitol buildings in Michigan was absolutely out of control. I'm not sure how many swastikas and Confederate flags were at Queen's Park on the weekend, if any.
I haven't seen any pictures, but I mean, there are lots of like the usual suspects, like QAnon folks, as we were talking about.
And it's usual.
It's anti-vaxxers.
Homemade signs, like, what was it? All health is essential, and social distancing is fake science, and I don't know if anybody was coughing. Some of them had masks on, but I don't know if that really was to cover their face or just to, in the spirit of the times, trying not to get COVID whilst at the same time protesting it. Who knows?
Right. And you had some, like, you have yellow vesters in Hamilton sort of, like, staking out the hospital parking lot to prove that the hospitals are empty. And I don't know about you, but even in, like, times that are not pandemic, I've never seen an empty hospital. So that seems a bit...
And that kind of leans back into conspiracy town, right? It's like, oh, hospitals are empty. Mm-hmm. Of all my visits there, it was empty once. And then, of course, it's the kind of thing that the people who work there would say, they'll say, don't say anything, because the second you do, like, they'll... 40 people will arrive, but it is a very it is a very rare thing for a hospital to be empty, in quotes, because they're never ever empty, never.
No.
So that's I guess that's all we can say about that for now. I'm sure there'll be more protests, at least. I'm surprised there weren't more people there, considering it's a town where Faith Goldie got 25,000 votes. You know. Again, that's another story for another day. I wonder if she's going to run again, but we've got a little bit of time before we're going to talk about that story. But next up, in relation to open carry and the like, gun control.
Mm-hmm.
This was kind of not quite out of the blue considering the times and what happened in Nova Scotia, but I guess anybody that was at the École Polytechnique 30 years ago, it was saying this is about time, that there's going to be a ban on 1,500 models and, as they call them, subtypes of assault weapon. That was announced last Friday. And I had a look at the list, quite an extensive list. And, of course, a lot of the guns are the usual ones that we hear about in mass shootings. But again, just before airtime, I saw, and you probably saw this too, Adam, that's the Canadian Coalition for Firearms Rights, because you have to say it like that, are filing a Section 7 charter challenge with regards to the right to life, liberty, and security of the person, calling the... it's an order in council. I'm not sure if people understand the difference, but an order in council is similar to an executive order in the U.S. The Queen's Privy Council is a group of advisors that advise the Prime Minister and the Cabinet on what to do. So they came up with that. It's completely legit within our system for them to bring something down like that. And another example would be the Harper government twice denying Omar Khadr citizenship was an order in council. So there's no real parallel to those, but there are times where the government can pretty much do what they want. Because this is one of the comments I heard, was, oh, they can't do that. Actually, they can. So it's going to be interesting to see where this charter challenge goes, if it goes anywhere.
Right. And it's so kind of, I mean, of course, we wanted something to get done right away in the wake of what happened in Nova Scotia a couple of weeks ago. But it also seems kind of lightweight in a way to me that you have this, you know, as you correctly called it, kind of an executive order action as opposed to legislation. And you, I have seen, you know, a number of groups, and a lot of the really anti-gun groups in Canada sort of sprang out of Montreal, what happened at L'École Polytechnique in 89, people either who were peers to the young women who died and started their group, you know, wherever they were, or, you know, people who were actually on campus that day, and even a couple who were survivors themselves. But in so much as, you know, they're happy with these developments, they are also pushing for the fact to change the classifications of firearms, because the concern is that you could have a more gun-friendly government come in and just sort of undo all this with kind of, you know, as Trudeau has done with a sign-off on a memo or whatever, that the cause of more gun control will be better served by being terribly specific about, you know, the, not just saying like we are banning gun A, but saying, you know, we are banning the characteristics of gun A. So like no bump stocks and no this, no automatic, no, I mean, automatic rifles are already illegal, but, you know, being really tight with the description, saying like, you want a gun? Okay. You can have gun A, gun B, with characteristics 1, 2, 3, but you know, everything else is kind of banned, and that's sort of like the next level of this. But as we've seen, like as you mentioned, the reaction to this already has been kind of overblown, even though it you know, feels to me like kind of a weak response.
Well, it's always overblown, right? Because they're like, oh, they're going to take our guns away, because there are people that have them. Let's call them collectors, for lack of a better word, but the people that seem to not just need a rifle for hunting and want all the guns that our American friends can get no problem out of a cereal box. Well, pretty close anyway. You can get it all. Maybe not all. But there are parts of this that need to be legislated, and I guess that's the vote part, in that the aspects of, are certain models going to be grandfathered in, so the thousands that are out there, will the law-abiding gun owners be able to hang on to them until they get stolen and used in something? Or and what was the other part that needs to be, oh, the buyback, right? If they're to decide whether they're going to buy back the guns as they've done in other places. Like, I believe that's what they did in New Zealand, right? It sounds to me like this is very much inspired. They're hoping some of the Jacinta Ardern, the leader the world needs right now, mojo rubs off on them, because that after the Christchurch shootings, which were of a similar scale, I believe there was more people actually killed and injured. Not that that those numbers matter, but the shootings in the Islamic Center and the mosque down there pretty much changed their gun law overnight, or within a very short period of time as well.
The difference too is, I think there's I don't know New Zealand culture that well, but they are not influenced by a country right next to them that is, you know, over the top sort of open carry with guns, you know, and where guns have sort of like permeated the mindset and permeated the culture. I mean, even that's not entirely true, because in the United States, you have even 60% of people. Last time I heard a polling on this, 60% of people saying that semi-automatic weapons should be banned. So even the culture in the United States is changing. But having said that, you know, being in a lot of things, being bumped up right against the United States has a negative effect on our politics here, and I think this is one of those. And certainly not helping things is Michelle Rempel, who has an Our Commons petition out, which I think, when I checked it earlier, was so far been signed by 122,000 people.
Oh, it's even higher. Yeah, I saw 115, but yeah, it's, who's signing it though? Is it people in Oklahoma where she's stationed right now, or is it actual Canadians?
Well, that's the thing, isn't it? And
is it Big Bird from 123 Sesame Street? Yeah, like that's
right. Because she's in Oklahoma, and it's like, well, I don't know how they do things in Oklahoma, Michelle, but you know, it, we don't have that culture. We don't have the, you know, let's run down to the guns and booze store, which, you know, you go to Michigan, that's like the first, you cross the border at Sarnia. That's pretty much the first business you come to as soon as you get over the border is a guns and booze shop. Mm-hmm. That culture doesn't exist here. And it's rapidly going away too, as we sort of become more urban, and as, you know, gun violence is strictly urban. And you know, you made the point too that the argument is this is affecting lawful gun owners, but the thing is, well, yeah, all if you're a gun manufacturer, you're not making guns for criminals. You're not releasing these guns saying this is going to be a great gun for somebody to go and rob a bank with. It's, you know, you're not, that's not how you're selling it.
No.
If there is no legal market for semi-automatic weapons, that gives them no reason to produce, or no reason to produce as many, which means there are fewer of them that can be obtained illegally. So,
well, and that's it. I mean, generally in Canada, I think it, and our number's higher here in terms of automatic weapons, I think it's 80% of people say, no, you shouldn't have them. No one's going to argue that people shouldn't hunt in this country. It's just not, it's not going to happen. That's, it's almost a separate channel that argument's on, in terms of like, no, hunting, keep on hunting, because that's how we roll in vast parts of this country. But as in terms of automatic weapons and handguns too, which again is almost another category, and looking at it politically, the Liberals are going to pass the other rules that are going to back this up are going to need the support of at least one other party, and that the Bloc are saying they want more clarity on the buyback and how that's going to work. But the NDP are saying that they want more clarity on the details of in general, but are they going to tackle the smuggling up from the US, which is a massive problem? And of course, as you mentioned, the Conservatives are like, why are you ramming all of this through when no one's sitting? So they're making the argument. It's like, oh, the Liberals are doing this because it's hard to argue points at a Zoom meeting, right? So probably.
Well, let's face the facts too, that it's not the circumstances that the Conservatives object to. And, you know, see again, Michelle Rempel's petition, that, you know, in the best of circumstances, this was never going to be this was never going to get by without a knife fight from the one side of the aisle.
Repeal, what did she call it? Repeal the firearms confiscation scheme.
Right, exactly.
Yeah, okay.
And I should point out too that it's, you know, even on the right, this is a lightning rod, because the post-millennial, which is not a
sorry,
it's not an outlet I typically visit, but I happened upon it today, and they dug up a 2000 article that Peter McKay wrote when he was just a regular old MP from Nova Scotia, basically calling for a ban on semi-automatic weapons, which is basically what the Liberals have proposed. And this is the same Peter McKay who was pictured a couple of years ago at an Edmonton fundraiser wearing a T-shirt that had an AR-15 and a maple leaf sort of smushed together, and the words "No Compromise" written underneath.
Was so a lot like of a people. Are, was that like in the Dream? The Dream, yeah. Logo of the maple, right, leaf and the AR-15.
Right, and so together Peter McKay has had to, I guess, buttress his, this, you know, suspicion that he's not like all the way with, you know, open gun carrying, because he's, you know, come out against this and you know, talked about the tyranny of the Liberals and all that, even though he's from Nova Scotia, represented Nova Scotia at one time, and you know, the act that sort of spurned the immediacy of this was happened in Nova Scotia the other week. I do want to say one other thing, which this does not address, which is between 2000 and 2016, 9,919 out of 13,168 gun deaths in Canada had nothing to do with murder. They were all because people took their own lives. So right, that's like 3/4 of all gun deaths in Canada are because of suicide, and nobody kills themselves with a semi-automatic gun. And I mean, unless it's a handgun, of course, but I mean, when we're talking about the long guns, the rifles and all that,
Yeah, it's very difficult to do.
You're right. Yeah. So, I mean, while this does address sort of the more extreme side of this, the massacre side of this, there's an even bigger massacre, which is, you know, 3/4 of all gun deaths in the country, in this country, are people taking their own lives. And these actions don't necessarily help those people either.
Well, on that note, we'll take a little bit of a break now for some PSAs and station ID and all the like we normally do. So this is sort of getting back into a slightly more normal groove, but you're listening to Open Sources here on CFRU 93.3 FM, and we will be back momentarily. My honey lamb and I sit alone and talk and watch a hawk making lazy circles in the sky. We know we belong to the land, and the land we belong to is grand. And when we say, no! I-F-I-O-E-A, we're only saying, you're doing fine, Oklahoma, Oklahoma, okay. Well, that's possibly the trolliest thing I've ever played on this show. That was from the Oklahoma soundtrack. I think it was in the 50s. One of the people singing was Shirley Jones of the Partridge Family, and that was Rodgers and Hammerstein's Oklahoma. So I thought it a bit apropos, you know, considering the times, and it's good to play something a little bit lighthearted for a change rather than that deep and serious stuff I always play. No, not really. But anyway, that was for, well, we know who that song's for. Who is not listening?
See back earlier in the show.
Yeah. Who is, she's probably not listening, and that's fine. So the PSW, which is personal support worker and long-term care situation in Ontario. Not a good situation just in this province, but also in Quebec. It sounds like many PSWs in Quebec are now the army. It sounds like the military or medical corps is maxed out, filling in. For the lack of staff due to myriad reasons. And in Ontario, I believe, I don't know if you heard, Adam, it was in Quebec, it was Orléans that another personal support worker has died from COVID-19.
Mm-hmm. What? I mean, there have been 4 here in Ontario PSWs that have died. I think one of the things I've kind of learned from this is that we've invested a lot of trust in an industry that, you know, the personal support worker industry. And I don't say this to impugn anyone who's a PSW, but having talked to someone from the Ontario PSW Association this week on the other podcast I do.
Yeah, that's on Politico. I heard a bit of that. It's on Politico, right? It was Janet Greener, is that right?
Yeah, that's right.
Worth checking out, people, by the way, and just a little bit of a plug there, but...
It is worth checking out because, you know, to understand sort of what's going on with, you know, why so many people are sick, why this is sort of overrunning long-term care, where a number of PSWs are employed, 130,000 here in Ontario. This industry has no standards, no sort of standardized education, no kind of set rules about who's hired as a PSW, what education they require, how much they should get paid, how they should be scheduled. They're all basically, you know, sort of freelancers in a way. You know, that was one of the big things early on in this, that if you're a PSW, chances are you are working at this long-term care facility and working at home with this other person and then working in this other facility and maybe picking up different shifts here and there. It's kind of a free-for-all. It's the old West. And people who are in the PSW industry, including Janet Greener with the Ontario PSW Association, which is the closest thing to sort of like a advocacy group for this industry, will acknowledge it's a free-for-all. It's the Wild West out there. And you got to think if there's sort of – I mean, there are a lot of things we're going to have to address after COVID-19 has passed. But, I mean, that's definitely one of them, is that when people in that industry who are trying their best acknowledge that they have sort of been left behind, or a lot of it has been left on them without the sort of regulatory backing to justify the power and responsibility they've given, bad things are liable to happen.
And it's gig economy structurally, and it's been that way for a long time, and that goes way back. And not only that, just in terms of long-term care homes and retirement homes, but then there's another layer of people that come in and out, specialists, physiotherapy, speech therapists, along with people that do various medical procedures. And by the nature of those things, there are people traveling to different locations. You can't have somebody like that working in one location just by what they do. Say you're the person that looks after dialysis equipment. That is another layer to this as well. But sticking specifically with PSWs, and of course, well, you know my history, Adam, and the people that know me know that I was somewhat embedded in this for a while. In fact, I was told I would probably make a pretty good PSW from what I had to do over a number of years, because it's a trial by fire thing. And if you want the layer of care that you want for your the elder in your life, you need to get in there. And I'm saying you need to, and I'm talking in the past tense too, because this is a few years ago with me now. And I knew then that this, I never thought it would be to this scale that it was going to be a problem, but this obviously doesn't surprise me at all, considering not just long-term care homes, but there's a million people in Canada that receive home care, which is another layer of PSW, because that is the degree of PSW as well. There's varying degrees of what people do, and some of them are, you know, the majority of the ones that I got to know over the years, absolute all-stars, and I don't know, we could call them miracle workers. These days, they're definitely doing miracles, or at least trying to, considering not only the times, but how many of them have ended up ill. But let's go back to the political reasons, and this is where I seem completely partisan in my comments, but we know in the 1990s, when this started to be more deregulated and quote, to cut red tape, was by Mike Harris, who is now the chair of Chartwell Homes. Yeah. That is a fact. I'm not just saying that to score some kind of political point. You know, the ties that bind between, you know, the certain parties in government, certain previous players in government, and the way the situation is now, they should all go down because of this. And it does include the current government as well. They don't want to talk about it. They're throwing all kinds of resources at stuff, and they're saying, well, we're going to give you more pay. And even though this current government was structured on cuts, right? Opposition NDP were pushing for a minimum complement of care. Government's like, no way. We need to do these things, or things are going to happen, or things are already happening within the system. I think I talked about it before, where the flu is a prime example of something that goes through retirement homes and long-term care homes, and people die. And it's an accepted fact of the structure of the thing that people die because of, let's call them, small pandemics. And it's not due to lack of care on any one PSW person's part or anything. It is the structure of the system. So now we have that times 1,000 or more. And it's no surprise that it's not on the verge of collapse. It has collapsed. The building has collapsed, and they're pulling people out, right?
Right. It's I mean, it's pretty dire when you sort of see it by the statistics. And there was the International Long-Term Care Policy Network did a study. They didn't include the U.S., U.K., or Italy in the study, which is, of course, like three places where COVID-19 has hit especially hard. But they did look at Canada, and 62% of Canada's COVID-19-related deaths, which is the highest in any of the 13 countries they studied, were people in long-term care. And when it comes to people over 60 years old, and these are federal statistics, the Public Health Agency of Canada, they think the number could be as high as 82%.
Yes, because I saw a different synthesis of that number of somebody who is going through, you know, let's just say their own spreadsheet of that, and her percentage was 80.
Right,
which is not, and that's, you know, picking apart, because there are certain jurisdictions, and this is one of them actually, where they don't reveal where the COVID deaths are, so they won't say it's from this place or that place. But in some instances, it's unavoidable when there's been a mass number of people that they can't keep it out of the media, that they have to say, look, this place is in crisis.
And when you break it down, like people 60 years and older, they make up 36% of the fatalities, or no, 36% of the cases, 67% of the hospitalizations, and 95% of the deaths. That's people over 60. Now, that's not all in long-term care, but that shows you how sort of uniquely vulnerable that the older population is. Once you sort of cross the magic 60 line, you sort of become terribly vulnerable to COVID-19. And the other part of this too is, I mean, what's happening right now in long-term care is a crisis. And you think it will take a crisis to change things, right? Well, not so fast, because this has nothing to do with pandemics, but, you know, definitely a killer of a sort. Does everyone remember Elizabeth Wetlaufer?
Yes.
Who was an angel of death that was killing older residents in long-term care homes. They did a public inquiry into that after she was arrested and convicted. They came up with 91 recommendations. A lot of those were focused on increasing funding for long-term care homes and increasing staff at long-term care homes. They were systematically vulnerable, the report said. I want you to guess how many of the 91 recommendations were done when they last checked in February.
I'm going to say if not one, then zero.
Actually, 18.
Oh, okay.
They did 18 out of 91. A lot of these were involving like the medication checks, because obviously Elizabeth Wetlaufer used medication to murder people. So they've tightened those controls. But the big ones are staffing and money. And that has not been done. And this is almost a year later. This report came out in July of 2019.
Well, because
that was, yeah.
No, I was going to say that is the kind of thing that probably, and all have to be fair that not all of the long-term care homes and places where this is going on are private, mm-hmm. but there is a massive element of privately owned ones and private industries that work, and it is industries that work within that environment, which it's a problem. And until, you know, you've probably seen it these days where there'll be articles advocating for, like, we need to nationalize that, and we need to bring it into OHIP, and we need to bring it into the healthcare system, rather than it being this kind of hands-off amorphous thing, like, okay, let's put the seniors over here, and then let's people take care of them, and then let's make a lot of money off of them. But going back to the PSWs just quickly before we change it up again, I'm sure people have seen that there's been, you know, the protests in terms of getting more PPE and protective gear to the PSWs. And that, I mean, that's obviously a problem with this as well, because you wouldn't believe, I don't think people realize, unless you know somebody within, let's call it the system, how hands-on and how close you need to be to people. So, I mean, if there's any question as to how this is spreading like wildfire, and I'm not blaming PSWs necessarily, because this, as we know, COVID is a back-and-forth thing. It's like that, it is so intense in that environment, because it is, you know, there is a medical aspect to it, but also whether it was just helping people, you know, change their clothing or whatever, or even helping them eat. It is so, it's intimate. It really is. Like, you know, the interaction is a very close one. And, yeah. You know, I would hope that the PPE is getting out to the workers now. And of course, to the residents as well, because it is a bit of a back and forth. But that alone, until that's directly addressed. Because I don't know, this isn't really getting any better statistically, is it? Like, the numbers that we see on the increase in that are still... It's still the same, right?
Yeah,
the numbers, this community. We know it's spreading within the community, but in terms of the hard numbers that we get of known cases and tested cases, it's like seniors, people that work in healthcare, and people that work in retirement environment is the majority, right? Is that
right? The battle is kind of being fought in the hospitals and the long-term care homes, and, you know, the healthcare facilities. For the most part, because people have been sheltering in place and doing social distancing and all of that, it has not been, we have not kind of seen the big thing, at least in Guelph anyway, the Guelph, Wellington, Dufferin coverage area. The big concern has been in the facilities, and I think that is the ongoing concern, which is why you have the government calling out the the army and all that to assist in those facilities. Because, of course, it's not just the fact that there's an outbreak. It's that the people who work in these places are being exhausted by having to respond. And that's one of the things Janet Greener said, that right now the big problem is, you know, sort of not the disease, but the people, but exhaustion. Exhaustion is sort of like the secondary pandemic to COVID-19, at least for like first responders and people who work in the medical fields.
Well, if that system doesn't get changed up after this, first of all, I don't know what will. And secondly, we've all failed. If nothing happens, and we need to make sure, this is a bit of an editorial right now, but need to make sure that something happens.
Right. And I mean, Del Duca has called for an inquiry. Horvath called for an inquiry. There's another group this week that called for an inquiry. I think
that's the minimum.
It's easy to put that off as we're still kind of dealing with the crisis day to day, but that's going to be pretty hard to ignore once like things are kind of getting back to quote unquote normal.
Yeah, I might have to get out of the chair and this chair. And anyway, that's another, obviously, a story that's a continuing story that we will definitely cover in another day.
Yep.
So going back a bit in history, 50 years since the campus unrest, as they called it, back in the, I was going to say the 60s, is a product of the 60s, but in 1970, where four students were killed at Kent State in Ohio. And of course, this is the campus unrest that's on everybody's mind generally, because, you know, when Crosby, Stills, Nash and Young write a song about you, it was actually Neil Young wrote the song, but anyway, that's another. it's always top of mind on this anniversary date every year. I think the New York Times said that America was never the same after that shooting. Now, within that time frame, I sort of knew about this, but it came to the fore again because it has been 50 years that, you know, this, people think of Kent State as a one-off thing. The amount of protest that was going on, not just for Vietnam, but also in the civil rights area within that period of time, culminating in 1970, sort of capping off the 60s, was an incredible amount. And there was the shooting that never gets, the shooting of students that never really gets mentioned. It's always a secondary thing, but it happened a couple of weeks later at Jackson. I think it's now Jackson State University. It was Jackson State College then in Jackson, Mississippi, where the police, it was like city and state police fired on the students there. It was called, quote, racial tensions, and two people were killed and 12 injured. So it was sort of an echo paralleling what had happened at Kent State, which was a protest specific to America's incursion into Cambodia, which, and again, I did, the Vietnam War was never formally declared, was it?
No, there's like, no, they never congressional said, declaration.
Yeah. So they went into Cambodia as well to try and track down presumably the Viet Cong. And there was the protest that you talked about, and four dead in Ohio.
Right. I mean, it's important to sort of keep in mind the buildup to that. And yeah, the flashpoint was the invasion of Cambodia. Of course, Nixon ran in 68 as the candidate that was going to end the Vietnam War, which by that point had been going for more than a dozen years. And I'm glad you mentioned the Jackson State killings too, because there was a great piece in The Guardian that sort of highlighted the differences in white America, black America. There was a police shooting in South Carolina, where there were students protesting racial segregation there, and three black kids were killed, and there were 27 wounded. And the only person that went to jail was one of the protesters, and they were basically charged with, you know, the equivalent charge of like causing a riot, basically. So it was interesting to view Kent State through that lens. Like, one of the reasons this caught on, of course, has to do with the fact that it was white kids in a suburban university setting, as opposed to black kids in the South protesting for civil rights. And that's one of the reasons why this sticks out too. For me, one of the reasons to it's interesting to revisit this, and I was reading a lot of the witness statements and the survivors, and a lot of them were talking about how they didn't think the guns were real, and they were slow to react because they didn't think that it was gunshots they were hearing, that they thought the National Guardsmen who were on campus were armed with like BB guns or sort of like prop guns. And I mean, it speaks to the incredible naivete of white college kids in 1970, but it also speaks to like just how far we've come. Can you imagine, you know, being on an American campus in the year 2020 and seeing somebody, even a police officer, in riot gear, or someone who looks like they could be an army officer with a machine gun walking around your campus and going, huh, I wonder what they're playing at here. I wonder if that's a real gun they have.
Well, and that was one of the changes that came out of this, that it wasn't completely in vain, in that the tactics and how they dispersed riots. There was an inquiry after this, of course. Nixon, as you know, as you should do, struck an inquiry. It had some weird name, like the inquiry into campus unrest, or whatever they were calling it. The Commission on Campus Unrest.
Sounds right.
So, and it's the kind of thing normally that nothing comes of it, but the conclusion that came out of that, of course, the Kent State killings and woundings weren't justified at all and was denounced. But that's the kind of thing that comes out a couple of years later, and it's still, you know, somewhat fresh in people's minds. But it seems back in the day that, considering how divided America was, that there was a good chunk of America that didn't have any sympathy for the Kent State students at all.
Right, and that's something interesting.
Like polarized nation, like not unlike now, but the division was, you know, our boys are in Nam, you know, how dare you, in certain circles, right?
Right, it's interesting because that Guardian article I mentioned also referenced, it was basically about how like the divisions in America can be traced back to Kent State to a certain extent. There were a number of sort of like blue collar white workers at the time who were very anti-war, but at the same time, they hated the anti-war movement. They hated the young people. They thought the young people were entitled, that as you said, that they weren't, you know, sticking up for the troops, which is, you know, sort of weird. You're against the war, but you like the troops. But having said that, it's interesting to look back, because I feel like there's a similar thing going on in America right now.
Yes.
Where people, there's, again, we mentioned that when we were talking about gun control in the United States, there is widespread agreement that there should be some form of gun control. There is widespread agreement that the rich people need to be taxed more. There is widespread agreement that they need at the very least a public option so that everybody is covered in health care. Covered in healthcare? That was weird.
Covered in healthcare. It sounds positively socialist. I don't know. They're going to go for it.
But, you know, there is widespread agreement on these points. But then you hear, like, oh, America's more polarized than it's ever been. Which is so weird, because people like the policy. They don't like the people advocating for the policy.
Well, yeah. And that's the fair point. I mean, as you were saying about the division between, like, let's call the workers and academics. If you go back a couple of years to the Paris in 1968, where there was this collaboration between students and workers, and they thought that the French government was going to collapse. And Nixon thought the same thing out of this. There's this weird, I had seen the picture before, but I didn't know what it was. They what did they call it? The Night of the Weird, where there was a protest about a week after Kent State, where like 100,000 people went to Washington and were protesting, and supposedly Nixon couldn't sleep and went down to the Lincoln Memorial. It's a bit changed these days. It's Trump there now, but a bunch of hippies sleeping, and Nixon is trying to talk to them. And they took a picture of this, and supposedly it was like one of the weirdest presidential moments. And we've had lots of those in the past 4 years, obviously.
And but it's wonderfully dramatized in Oliver Stone's Nixon.
Oh, right. Yeah, yeah.
With when Nixon goes down to the memorial and tries to be buddies with some of the protesters there, and it kind of it doesn't backfire spectacularly, but he gets deeply uncomfortable very, very fast.
And
it's I'm Dick Nixon. It's like, yeah, remember, you're kind of like bombing a country, dude.
I remember seeing that, and there's something ripped out of a movie. But when we think about the, you know, to kind of wrap it up a bit, when we think about the 60s and how this was sort of the a footnote, I guess, mm-hmm. I would think the 60s didn't start in 1960. It started when the three civil rights workers were killed in the summer before or the summer after the Kennedy assassination. So you could say that the amount of killing of people of known and unknown, of significant people like Kennedy, Kennedy's brother, Malcolm X, Medgar Evers, Martin Luther King Jr. It was the era of the assassination. It wasn't all love and flowers. Like, people were getting killed outright for their political beliefs. It's incredible. Like, could you imagine that era now? Could you imagine if through 2010 to now, that like all six or seven massively significant leaders, and there would probably be more women among them now, were just assassinated in America or in Canada? Like, that is incredible.
Well, in a sense, that era still kind of exists. And I'm thinking today of Ahmaud Arbery, who is this poor guy who was jogging through a Georgia neighborhood and was chased down and killed by a retired white cop and his son.
Who were suspicious.
For the crime of running on a nice spring day. So, I mean, in a sense.
Oh, no, it's not gone. No, it's not gone for sure. And like I said off the top, or whenever I said that, let's be glad in this country that everybody's not just kind of walking around with a gun and wants to take it into their own hands. Well, Adam, believe it or not, we're all, I don't feel talked out, but we're definitely at that point in the show again. You've been listening to, once again, Open Sources here on CFRU 93.3 FM in Guelph. Please join us at this time, hopefully every week at 5 o'clock for more of this show. And Adam, if people were looking for more info on you, where can they reach you?
I can be found on Twitter and Instagram at Adam A. Donaldson, or you can go to my political site at guelphpolitico.ca.
And I'm Scotty Hertz on Facebook and Scotty Hertz on Twitter. And I don't know what the heck else I'm doing, but I have to go. It seems there's a clanking sound from the top of the bunker. I think somebody's trying to undo the wheel that's holding the lid on it. So,
oh no.
Anyway, thanks so much for joining us, folks, and we will be back next week, same bat time and channel. And take care, Adam. I'll talk to you during the week there. But
will do.
Good to hear from you again.